down.
All right. Welcome back to the Earl Ingram Show. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789. It's 844-967-2789. You can text us at the same number. It's Monday. That means Mondays with Sandy Williams. I want to go directly to the phone line. Sam, who do we have on the line?
We have Eric from Tosa calling in.
Hey, Eric, how you doing, man? Thank you very much for the call. You say what?
Hey, Earl, how are you doing this morning?
I'm doing fine, man. It's good to hear from you.
Good, good. Hey, I wanted to ask a quick question just off topic real quickly. Are you familiar, I'm sure you are, with Detroit Lions players Mel Farr and Lem Barney?
Absolutely, man. How could I not be?
Now, my question is, do you know how they are directly connected to your show?
Huh?
No, man. How?
I didn't think so. Okay, here it is. Now, you open your show every time, even back in the old days,
with Marvin Gaye, right? Yeah. Right.
They are the voices hanging out with Marvin Gaye in the beginning, sang backup vocals on that song.
Really?
Huh.
They sang backup vocals on that song. They're friends in Detroit.
Mel Farr.
Wow, and Lem Barney, man.
Wow.
Wow,
yeah,
man.
They're buddies of his, and they agreed to sing on there because he tried out for the Lions, I believe, and they kind of traded off.
Yeah,
like,
he was an athlete.
Or vice versa.
Yeah, you're right, man.
Yep.
Hey, that's some great information, man.
Yeah, just some crazy trivia. Being a Lions fan, I can't help but know that.
Hey, you know what, man? I've been a Lions fan all my life, going back to Milt Plum and Dick Night Train Lane. And
Night Train. So Mel Farr, was he a D-back?
He was a D-back.
Yeah.
Mel Farr, no, running back. Mel Farr,
Mel. No, are you sure?
I thought it was Lem Barney.
He was a running back.
Mel Farr was a running back. And Barney
was the D-back.
Lem Barney was a Hall of Fame cornerback.
Yeah, he was a cornerback. He's right. You're right.
Yeah.
Yeah, man, you that's some great trivia. Go ahead.
Yes, let me tell you, as what you're talking about earlier, Gary's talking, and I'm kind of in the same situation as Gary, although I think completely differently as a result. Moving in with family because he has too much pride to accept welfare, or his mother did, is welfare. That's a form of welfare. You move in with your family. There's a sense of pride in that too. But nonetheless, that was just something. We did the same thing. I moved in with grandparents. But again, the opportunities afforded white folks all the way down the line that aren't to others is what deludes white people into thinking, why doesn't everyone else do this? So real quickly, and I'd like to say, if white people don't understand why people that don't look like them don't do as well as themselves, is that ignorance willful? Because it is truly ignorance, not fact. And like Gary and others, I'm not picking on Gary, I promise you, but most white folks have taught themselves to really accept their lot and let our centuries-old ongoing white supremacist doctrine kind of take care of the rest, with the only guarantee really being that they'll never fall to the level of black people in this country. And that's really what they cling to.
Hey, man, listen, I can't I have to say to you, man, in all candor, You are really, and I've always loved you and what you've always added to any program that I've been on. You've been very truthful, and you're that now. Sandy, you want to respond?
Well, no, you're right. I mean, I think the problem is people only know what they know, and we don't have, I don't think we teach ourselves enough in our society about empathy and projection, trying to figure out the situation of other people have. So if all we do is project the experience we've had personally, it permits us to do exactly what you've said, which is to be in denial about the problems that might beset other folks as a function of their birth. And, you know, that's what I hope the politics turns around and becomes in the next while, which is just evaluating how America provides the same birthright to everybody in this country when they're born, and evaluates how we are not doing that right now, and figures out the difference between those two, and how do we get to the point of everyone's having the same birthright, or as close to it as possible. Obviously, we all can't be born Elon Musk's son.
Right.
Of course, if we that's not necessarily great because you'd have a name no one could pronounce, but you know, we can't all have an equal kind of a notion of exactly what we step into, but we can all have a birthright that gives us essentially equal opportunity.
You know, but for every Sandy, and I'm sorry, I forgot caller's name.
Eric.
And for every Sandy and Eric who are willing to have an honest discussion on this, there's so many who are not, and who will be angered by the conversation, and I've never understood why they get angered by the conversation. And if I was to say what Sandy and what Eric just said, I would be vilified,
threatened.
Yes.
Well, I think, you know, anger is related to fear. And in fact, they're almost directly related, and you almost can't have anger without fear. And so it relates to social fears. And it's a fear, maybe it's a fear driven by a subconscious knowledge that it's true, and it's been, you know, you're in denial about it. Or it's a subconscious fear that somehow, you know, we have privilege, we white have privilege that we will lose, and that privilege is somehow important to our status, and that we might, and I think that has a lot to do with it. It's a reactionary concern.
And if I can
concern.
Add, Sandy, to
yeah.
what you just said?
Yeah.
I'm sorry. What you just said about that privilege, I believe that from my perspective, we're also raised and conditioned to be willfully ignorant and to not believe that the troubles of other people are even important enough for us to worry about. And in that sense, we get to a point where right now what you're talking about, that privilege and that fear of falling below to the level of those people you always fear falling to, is what is making this current thing, this current movement, more important than actually democracy for a lot of people.
Yeah, yeah. Well,
I've said this before, and you kind of step back and said it's a little bit, flaming, so to speak, like, you know, saying that, and you know, but truly, these folks are deciding, making the decision that they will roll with this movement, take the democracy down. It's more important that I remain where I'm at.
Well, I think
for the whole country.
It's because their version of democracy, the version of democracy they're thinking of, and when they talk about founding fathers with a Judeo-Christian heritage, is a dog whistle for describing a democracy in which the culture that they are all used to, this white culture, is the prevalent culture that prevails in the country, regardless of whether,
and that privileges them.
And yeah, which also secures an ongoing privilege. And you know, it's a status
thank
quo.
You.
It's a status quo that.
Thank
they,
you very much for the call, Eric. Yeah. Really appreciate it.
It's a status quo that people want to hang on to, even though that status quo is obviously in the process of evolving. There's no doubting the fact that, I mean, the critical race theory furor is all about the unwillingness of people. It's like people whose spouse says, let's go to family counseling, and they say, no, we don't have any problems.
Right.
We're not going to go to family counseling. And they know that the reason they really don't want to go is because all the problems they
They're
have
gonna
will,
be
will be revealed.
Yeah.
And so, you know, that's pretty much what I think the furor of critical race theory is all about, is if we really roll up our sleeves and look at the world that realistically. Now, you know, the fact that we chose, or there was a decision made to call it critical race theory, it belies really what is being talked about, because that was a name of a course in a law school that was evaluating something from a totally different perspective than what was being taught or is being taught in grade school and high school curricula, which is simply to talk about the fact that plantations, the source of wealth for the South, the wealth was created by slavery. And to attach those two, so that to say that Southern wealth was built off the backs of slaves, which is
true, 100%
altogether 100%
right.
True. And that is not to be taught because it somehow reflects badly on the circumstance, even though it's history.
You know, Sandy, my concern about it all is I watched my dad, didn't know my granddads, never got to see either of them, but my dad, through his entire life, worked hard, did all the things that he could, never committed any crimes that I'm aware of, you know, showed me how to be a provider, and that's what he did his entire life. He was a provider and was there. And so when you see in many men like him, and through their entire lives, they were never able to get beyond that. They were always looked at in a manner as not quite good enough, and only because of the color of their skins. And that's the way this nation had it through his entire life. And here I am now in the latter stages of my life. And a lot of that still exists today. And then I look at my sons and say, well, listen, how long do we have to continue to deal with that in this country before at some point in time people are going to say enough already, right? I mean, you can't be a great nation, I don't care how you say it, if you aren't treating people equitably and fairly inside of your nation. I don't care about all the rest of that. But if people aren't all being treated fairly in your nation, you're not a great nation. I'm just, you know.
Well, you know, and we...
Especially to the people who are on the other side of that.
And, you know, the rest of the world looks at this.
Yes, the rest of the world knows that.
Looks at the incarceration rate we have in the United States and looks at what is public about the way the United States is divided and its wealth is divided. And then we run around the world telling people...
Yes.
How they should govern themselves. We tell China, you know, with China's got problems in their governance. Well, you know, China's trending in many good directions. They've got problems. They've got government is a messy process, whether it's democracy or whatever is installed. And you know, there are some good homilies about the fact that democracy is the worst, is the best of three bad options, essentially, in terms of what kind of government you could install.
Senator, we got to go to break. We'll be right back. 844-967-2789. You're tuned into the Early Group Show. Sandy Williams is here. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Earl Ingram Show. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789, 844-967-2789. Text us at the same number. It's Monday. That means Mondays with Sandy Williams. You know, Sandy, this article I want to talk about before we get into Ukraine. Bernie Sanders calls out Congress over proposed Jeff Bezos bailout. Bernie Sanders talking about corporate welfare. Have you ever heard that anywhere? Senator Bernie Sanders took to the pages of The Guardian on Friday to inveigh against legislation currently before Congress that, if approved, could provide billionaire Jeff Bezos' space flight company with a lucrative NASA contract to build a moon lander. At a time when over half of the people in this country live paycheck to paycheck, that sounds like Sandy Williams, when more than 70 million are uninsured and underinsured, and when some 600,000 Americans are homeless, should we really be providing a multi-billion dollar taxpayer bailout for Bezos to fuel his space hobbies? Sanders, chair of the Senate Budget Committee, wrote, "The time is now," he added, "to have a serious debate in Congress and throughout our country as to how to develop a national space policy that does not imply socialize all of the risks and privatize all of the profits. The bill at issue is the COMPETES Act, a measure ostensibly aimed at bolstering U.S. semiconductor manufacturing, providing more funding for technological research and development, and enhancing the nation's space exploration efforts." Last thing. The Vermont senator has warned for weeks, including in remarks on the Senate floor, that the bill is rife with corporate welfare. Sanders has trained much of his ire on a provision that would give NASA's $10 billion to pick a company to build a second moon lander after the agency awarded SpaceX, a company owned by billionaire Elon Musk, $3 billion contract to make a lunar rocket last year. So, Sandy, I ask you, do we really have to go to the moon and at the expense of people struggling in the society? I mean, which one is more important?
Well, that's my concern.
I know, that's what you always say.
How does our government triage its expenditure of money? And the fact is that there's some kinds of money that we spend like drunken sailors, which is interesting. Sailors are part of the defense, right? You know, if it's got glitz like going to space, or if it's got the fear of loss of world dominance like our defense expenditures, it's Katie bar the door. We spend whatever, and that happens on a bipartisan basis. So, yeah, Sanders is right. The interesting thing is what he doesn't talk about is the fact that the support for chip manufacturing that's part of that infrastructure bill really involves the government trying to figure out ways to support and actually supplement and to provide the kind of financial aid to an industry
that
we criticize China for doing. China is apparently an unfair competitor, we say, because China takes billions of Chinese yuan and sticks them into industries like silicon chips and artificial intelligence, just as our government is now doing. So sauce for the goose is sauce for the gander. And, you know, the fact that they call their government communist and we call our government capitalist, but our government has a great deal of the same kind of subsidization process going on from the government level as China does. And China has just about as much privatization going as we do. So I don't know which is which. And much of our subsidization is done with the name of a tax break, okay? But tax breaks are direct government subsidies, essentially almost the same as the government taking money out of the till and handing it over. Now, the fact that SpaceX is owned by a single individual is not as important to me, because whether it's owned by a single individual or 2 million shareholders, it's privately held, and the profits are only what the government would essentially support in the way of profits in that sort of an agreement. I do agree with Sanders that socializing risk and privatizing profits is one of the issues associated with how the government provides its subsidies. And I believe that China does a better job, possibly, of policing that process than our government does, because the subsidizations that come from the Chinese government come with a bunch of strings attached associated with how they hire their workers and a whole lot of other things, that our government doesn't seem to do that. So, you know, I think we ought to examine our subsidization process, and I think we ought to understand that what we're calling unfair competition on the part of the Chinese exists in spades in the U.S. economy, and maybe we ought to do a better job, not of reducing the subsidies, but of do a better job of both policing them and figuring out how to better administer them.
You know, Sandy, time and time and time again, you always go back to the fact that we need to do something to make sure that children get a better quality of education and child care and all those things. And you never ease away from that. I don't care. You always go back to that.
Yeah.
But in this instance, this money that they're going to put into that, they say they can't afford to do what you keep saying.
Well,
there's no chance we can do that. We can't afford that.
That's the galling thing. You know, when I say triage, I'm talking about setting up priorities. And if we put, you know, if we did anything like a critical kind of a strategic plan for the U.S., we'd start listing the things we need to accomplish. And right up at the top would be this child birthright issue, this issue of having child daycare, of having adequate education, of assuring that every one of our next generations is better off than the generation before it. And yet, for the last several generations, what have we got? We've got each generation
worse,
less well off
right.
than the generation before it. We, the baby boomers, have set the mark, okay? We're the best off generation ever.
Right.
And every generation to follow us has not done as well and will not do as well. They won't do as well in retirement. So what have we done here? How have we failed to set our priorities so that we could have a country of ever better opportunities and ever greater chances for everyone born as an American or naturalized as an American? And yet, wow.
And yet we point our fingers at other nations that are attempting to do that.
Yes.
Right? And, well, it's socialism.
Yeah, attempting and many times
succeeding.
I mean, we can criticize China all we want, and we can look at the peccadilloes and the bad things they're doing with the Uyghurs and others, but they're creating a middle class at a rate that we could only hope to accomplish, and they're creating jobs at a rate that we could only hope to accomplish, and they're spreading wealth around their country in a very significant way, and they're controlling corruption in manners much better than, for instance, many other emerging countries. Most emerging countries, the biggest problem they've got is the rule of law and corruption. And so maybe the Chinese system has some merit, at least for the Chinese. I'm not saying that it should be exported to the United States or any place else, but it seems to have merit for the Chinese should we want to change it.
You know, we've got to go to a break. Phone lines are open, as always, at 844-967-2789. When we come back, Sandy, we'll talk a little bit about Ukraine and what's been going on there. You know, we're about to increase even more. Military support will be somewhere up around $4.5 billion, and it doesn't seem like it's anywhere near the end of what we're going to be adding. 844-967-2789. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Earl Ingram Show, as always. You can join us at 844-967-2789. 844-967-2789. You can text us at the same numbers. Mondays, that means Mondays with Sandy Williams. Sandy, it dawned on you the same time it dawned on me.
29 degrees.
29. Let me ask you something. So during the fall or before winter comes and freezing happens at 32 degrees.
Yeah.
So why is it that your plants, you have to cover them during the fall when it gets cold like that? But here it is, 29, the plants are up now, and many, those spring plants are up. Are they going to frost?
Well, I think those early bulb plants, like
they can take it, huh?
They can take it, you know, the snow, yeah. It's like some of them come up while there's still snow on the
ground.
Right.
Right.
Yeah, I think nature's got that covered for a while. I think we get 29 degrees in the middle of May, and then we got some problems.
Yeah, 29 degrees.
Yeah.
But anyway, I wanted to talk with you about Ukraine and the United States and things that are being said, and I wonder if people in the listening audience are paying attention. Maybe not, because you said this. You predicted this last week, or it might even been the week before. You said they're going to get tired of showing the same stuff. It's going to get old, we're not stuck. I'm not stuck to watching every move anymore.
Right, and you know, the fact is that the moves now are just as important as the moves were a couple of weeks ago. They were more startling then because it was new to us that there was this invasion, but our participation in it is escalating, if anything. The rate at which we're sending both money and weaponry has gone way up in the last 5 days. It's well over $1 billion that we've decided to send them. This weekend we send them our Secretary of State and our Secretary of Defense, who go there, and we start talking about things like mentioned by them of the fact that one of the goals here was to weaken Russia. And that, you know, the hope was that Russia would come out of this much weaker. And so, it begins to sound like a country, America, who's involved in a proxy war. By a proxy war, I mean someplace where they aren't sending boots on the ground, but they're arming other people's boots on the ground to suck the wind out of another country by having a warfare that is just debilitating. And the intention of that warfare is to debilitate this third-party Russia. And, of course, that fails to take into account what Russia's reaction will be to all of this and why Russia did this in the first place. Russia would say that they did this in the first place because they felt an existential threat from the expansion of NATO and the United States, therefore, as NATO being a proxy for it, into Ukraine on its doorstep after having already moved to the edge of all of Russia through the extension of NATO into the Baltic states. And so Russia says, well, we're feeling an existential threat. And then we start giving credence to it. A couple of weeks ago, there is the presidential gaffe where he says Putin can't stay in power any longer. Then we have this weekend, which is seems to be a much more formal declaration by the U.S. by spokesman saying that it's important that Russia be weakened in this process. It begins to sound like the United States is giving credence to the perceived risk by Russia that this is actually existential as far as Russia is concerned.
You know, Sandy, it clearly looks like we are stepping up, and you know, and the thing about it, Sandy, is initially this was well thought out. Our moves. Joe Biden basically kept a lid on things. He didn't want to move us into where we're headed now, but clearly we are headed somewhere that is going to lead us into something that many of us don't want to see. Let's do this. Let's go to the phone lines first. Who do we have on the line?
Bill from Oconomowoc.
Hey, Bill, how you doing, man? Thank you very much for the call. You say what?
Hey, Earl, you brought up a great point a little while ago. You were talking about Elon Musk and going up into space. But if the country was to put out a challenge to these super wealthy individuals, they have the ability to possibly change our line of thinking and part of our culture. Because here's where I'm coming from. I'm involved in Christian leadership and Christian ministry. If you want to make a difference, and if you want to put your life in perspective, help somebody. If you've got the ability with either your time or your money or both, if you can. But if we've lost our care for each other, that's just eroded away, and it's all about my personal right to not wear a mask, my personal right to carry a gun, my personal right to all this other crazy stuff. If we start caring about each other, we'll make a difference. But it may take somebody with the money like Elon Musk to come out with some marketing campaign to show it and show the effects of it. Because if you ever want to have a good day, help somebody. Because I'll tell you, it just takes one person that you're working with and you realize you don't have any problems. Everybody in Ukraine would trade immediate places with anybody in this U.S. And look at all the stupid stuff we whine and complain. We've become a country of self-centered children, but we have to move away for that. And I do believe part of the answer, well, not part of the answer, big answer, maybe the total answer, is the Christian outreach programs. So anyhow, thanks for what you talk about.
Hey Bill, thank you very much for the call. Let me say this, Sandy. Since today's Newsweek, Russia has sent a formal note to the United States demanding that Biden's administration stop sending weapons to Ukraine. Russian ambassador to the United States said on Monday in an interview on state-owned Russian language TV channel Russia 24, Antonov criticized Washington's latest $800 million arms package for Ukraine. President Joe Biden announced this on April 21st. Antonov told the broadcast channel that sending weapons to Kiev does not contribute to the search for diplomatic solution and settlement of the situation. This is a huge figure, he said. Antonov said the Kremlin in its formal notes stressed the unacceptability of the U.S. supplying Ukraine with weaponry. They sent them a formal letter, Sandy.
Well, yeah, I understand.
Does that matter?
Well, I don't know. The Russians actually have tended to stick to their word with respect to these kind of declarations, so it probably does matter. But I was listening to the Financial Times daily podcast, and they were doing an interesting analysis of the balance of power in this war and the notion that it essentially is a proxy war, and that the provision of arms to the Ukraine by the EU and the United States, this huge influx of weaponry, was going to shift over time the balance of power in the ground war, maybe in the direction of the Ukraine, because while Russia has 12,000 tanks or some huge inventory of weapons that are armored carriers and
nuclear
tanks,
weapons
and weapons of all kinds, as they are forced to dig deeper into their inventory, they're actually going back in time and getting less and less sophisticated weapons that they're bringing forth. Meanwhile, Ukraine's being supplied with state-of-the-art and increasingly state-of-the-art weapons, so that instead of moving backwards in time with Ukraine, that's moving forward, and we're beginning now to send them the latest U.S. weapons and the latest European weapons. Early on in this, we were sending them weapons out of the inventory of the Warsaw Pact countries going back to the Soviet period. And so that change in the balance of power will force to Russia to either give up the process, which everyone understands is altogether unlikely, or they will escalate the process and begin to use, for instance, their most sophisticated weaponry, hypersonic weapons, tactical nuclear weapons, the things that can give them a battlefield advantage, a significant potential battlefield advantage, lest and essentially dare the NATO countries and the U.S. to match that. And matching that, of course, has the real implication of World War III. And so this, again, brings back what I was saying at the beginning of this conflict, which is the geopolitical reality of this is that NATO and the U.S. do not put a strategic level import on the Ukraine that Russia does. NATO was not willing really to let Ukraine into NATO. They were maybe going to bring them in the EU, but not in the NATO, because they weren't willing to risk all of their treasure on defending Ukraine. And so what are we doing here?
We've changed.
Well, we've changed, but we're providing Ukraine with the wherewithal to defend itself to the last man. So you can take Mariupol as an example of what happens when you do that. Mariupol was we could look at that and say and congratulate the Ukrainians on their bravery right up until the time they get down to the last 1,000 men surrounded by Russians, being closed in on by the Russians. And now we're getting videos from these people saying this might be the last hours of our lives, because it's the Alamo. And so if you take that as an allegory, metaphor, a lesson for what's going to happen in this war, if we continue to handle this the way we are and make it a proxy battle and continue to arm the Ukraine so that they can defend themselves further and further into this battle, we're going to push it in the direction of a destruction of the infrastructure of Ukraine, a destruction of the people of Ukraine. It'll create a huge a problem between Ukrainians and Russians. But when you'll stand back from this thing, we will have created the potential, much greater potential for a disaster.
You know, Sandy, the more you look at Zelensky, the more resolved he is with knowing. Look, Mariupol is great to talk about, you know, the fact that people are willing to, you know, fight to the last man. That's not the case anymore. Some of the leaders are saying, listen, get us out of here. Right? From Ukraine. They're caught in there and they want out. You know, they don't want to die as martyrs.
Right.
So you know, I get that. If you have some sense, you would want to hold on to life, because dying as a martyr, what do you really get out of that, right? The only life that we know is the one we have. So why would you say, I'll step up, I'll become the martyr? Well, no, those people want out. And there has to be a deal struck, you know, in order to make that happen. And but we're getting closer to the point with what's happening with America's talking about more and more weaponry, that Russia's going to say there won't be any deal. We're going to slaughter those people.
Well, and you know, you think about it, and what we were essentially doing is protecting Ukraine from the need to negotiate with Russia and become a Georgia.
Right.
But we haven't really analyzed Georgia to figure out what's wrong, what's going wrong in Georgia for the people of Georgia. Lukashenko is more or less a dictator there.
So, Sandy, hold the thought. Got to go to a break. 844-967-2789. We'll be right back. Back to the Earl Ingram Show, as always. You can join us at 844-967-2789. It's 844-967-2789. You can text us at that same number. You know, it's Monday. That means Mondays with Sandy Williams. You know, Sandy, we talked about the fact that the war, we saw the early ground stuff, and, you know, Mariupol is now leveled. It and so the early ground stuff, I'm sure Russia didn't expect to lose as many of their, you know, state-of-the-art tanks and all of those things, and they thought that they had enough to handle Ukraine. But they're not dummies, and they also know that the reason that they've lost so much armament, they might not care as much about the lives, but you know, those are collateral, but they've lost so much of what it's taken them almost a lifetime to build with their military, a second lifetime after World War II. And to lose all of that, you know, at some point in time, that's going to have to be replaced, Sandy. They're also thinking about how much this has cost them, and it's only one place that they're looking at why. This shouldn't have happened to us. You know, and certainly all this excess money that we've had to spend is because the United States keeps doing this, right?
Well, there's no question that the United States is looking at this, and it's sort of apparently licking its chaps because apparently the Russians are losing both assets, human beings and mechanical assets at a 2 or 3 to 1 ratio compared to the losses in Ukraine. And so we can look at that and
pat ourselves on the back.
On the back with the Russian losses. But the Ukraine losses are very material, and particularly their infrastructure losses. And the Russian losses are a bitter pill that Russia's having to swallow that bitter pill. But they're going to step this up. They're going to do what's necessary in their book, because in fact, you know, like I said, they've decided, whether rightly or wrongly, that this is an existential problem, and we've done nothing to throw water on that fire by talking about, one, the fact that Putin can't stay in power, and two, saying that we want to make sure Russia comes out of this process weakened. Weakened how? And weakened why? And what are we going to do with a weakened Russia?
And why is it our issue?
Yeah, and why is it our issue? And of course, Putin is telling the Russians, well, they're trying to weaken us so they can destroy us. Yeah. Well, why are we trying to weaken Russia if not to do something else after it is weakened? You know, and that's a logic problem in terms of our what we're saying. So we're throwing not water on this fire, but we're throwing gasoline on the fire in the form of both what we're saying and what we're doing. And so I just think that, again, it's a problem of our geopolitical reckoning. And, you know, there's nothing particularly moral about foreign affairs. And admitting that there is a hegemony that various countries have over their region is something that our fellow, our Secretary of State, is saying it should be a matter of history, okay? He said it was a matter of history, except the United States is not willing to reject the notion that we have hegemony over maybe the world, but certainly the Western Hemisphere, and certainly both oceans. And so we have this very broad view of our hegemony, and yet we deny every other country's notion of their own hegemony. And clearly Russia, dating back to the USSR, has a very clear notion of its geopolitical turf, okay? And we are playing in their geopolitical turf, and we are failing to recognize how we would be reacting if someone was playing in our geopolitical turf.
You know, Sandy, if it's almost as if the majority of the American people, and at least the American people who should know better, don't even want to think about what you're talking about.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not thinking that hegemony is a good thing.
No, I know, but it's fact.
But it's fact.
Right.
It's fact. And it's a fact of international diplomacy, because international diplomacy is remarkably immoral. We prove that over and over again by who we decide to ally with, who we decide to support, who we decide to attack. It's just a matter of pragmatism, apparently. And pragmatism is the basis for this geopolitical concept.
So we don't have a right as the American people to know what's going on in our name across the world. Yeah, I would think that certainly as an American citizen, we should be able to ask questions at least about what's going on in our name. Because at the end of this, at the root of all of this, is maybe the destruction of the society, especially when we're talking about where this could lead. World War III is not, that used to be something that we would talk about and think that could never happen. I know I would never, ever have imagined that we would be as close as we are now, Sandy, to that. Let's hang on. Who do we have on the line, Sam?
CJ's calling from Stoughton.
All right, CJ.
Yeah, I'd be happy to hang. Thanks for taking my call,
hey,
Earl.
Let me say this, CJ. Hey, man, call back after the break, because we only got a couple
got
minutes.
It.
All right. Sandy, so about the American people not being aware. What?
Well, I mean, that's, you know, we've been talking about that, but this inability of America to carry out a dialogue about our foreign affairs and to try and get a more sophisticated understanding so that our foreign affairs could be sophisticated and deal with nuance and reality. But we don't do that, and we end up getting a script handed to us by whoever it is that decides what our foreign affairs should be. You know, how did we decide about Ukraine? A couple of years ago, Ukraine was an anecdote that related to a phone call from Trump to
right.
Zelensky that was, you know, it was news to everyone. And plus the fact Ukraine was viewed as a terribly corrupt country that was sort of a parallel to Russia, just operating under different leadership and what have you. And we end up not understanding what happened during the setback that was essentially maybe sponsored in some respect from the Russian leaning president of Ukraine to Zelensky, and all of the goings on that related to that was very important in the region and was below our radar screen in the United States, other than maybe our CIA and others who were following such things.
Yeah, I got to tell you, I'm not going to sit here and say I was on top of what was going on with the United States, Russia, and Ukraine, and I was not aware of the fact that this has been, you know, Russia and Ukraine have been kind of going at it since 2014. I was not aware of that. But once I started seeing what was going on, I started then focusing in on it. And I don't know how you cannot, seeing it for what it is now, Sandy, and envisioning where this thing is headed, World War III, you know, it's not so far in the distant, you know, and I'm not going to say in the distant future, because, you know, it was something that I would have never, ever thought would ever happen, especially not in my lifetime, because of the mutual destruction part of this. But you know, that part of it seems like World War III, you could see where it could accidentally happen, right? I mean,
well, yeah, I mean, the definition of World War, I didn't really understand it, I guess, but now that we're talking about it, you know, if you get the European nations involved, a number of them involved, you got a World War.
Yeah.
And if the number of them get involved, the U.S. gets involved.
And China?
And then you, China sitting on the backside of it, looking at how they'll get involved. Yeah, I mean, you can definitely see how it moves from X to Y pretty quickly.
All right, got to go to a break. 844-967-2789. We'll be right back. To keep our freedom, but Lord knows there's got to be a better way. Oh, whoa. Huh.